permit me here and now to promise as a good comrade and a fellow artist that I will not report any of this, whatever it is, to the police.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast. Each week, our intrepid group of researchers and music archivists dig through the record crates of the world, finding those albums that may have been lost over time. If a new artist is discovered along the way, that's all the better. Using a patent-pending algorithm and spirited debate, we pick one album to discuss. Once that is settled, we will invite the artists to Thunderlove Studio to chat with your hosts, Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun. When we're lucky, they say yes. Our mission with Abandoned Albums is simple: to make sure artists' recorded work remains, or in some cases, lands on, the cultural radar. We invite you to sit back and relax. Thank you for joining us.
As I was walking through a life one morning, the sun was out, the air was warm, but oh, 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 I was cold. No, I must have looked a half a person, could tell the tale in my own version. It was only then that I felt whole. Do you believe in something beautiful? Then get up and be it. Fight it for the smallest. Go to get a little self-control. I know how hard you try. I see it in your eyes.
Theodore Francis Leo, professionally known as Ted Leo, grew up in New Jersey on a healthy diet of the late 80s, early 90s New York City punk scene. After his first band, Chisel, called it quits, he formed Ted Leo and the Pharmacists. The group became known for their high-energy performances and politically charged lyrics, and helped his unique brand of rock and roll reach a larger audience. While never shedding his punk ethos, Ted evolved into a singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist with a Gen X spin. He's celebrated for his dynamic blend of punk, indie rock, and folk influences. Which is to say, his music isn't James Taylor and it's not Johnny Rotten. It's somewhere in between, and on a sliding scale. He gained prominence as the frontman of the band Ted Leo and the Pharmacists, known for their high-energy performances and politically charged lyrics. His distinctive guitar work, impassioned vocals, and sharp songwriting have earned him critical acclaim and a dedicated fan base. Throughout his career, Leo has released numerous albums that showcase his versatility and evolution as an artist. His work, to date, is an incredible tapestry spanning over three decades. Ted stopped by Thunderlove Studio in early February to chat with Jeff and me about his career and what he's working on right now. Here's our conversation with Ted Leo.
It's just the normal noises in here.
Welcome and thank you. Very happy to have you here.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks.
I think I mentioned this when I reached out to you, that I saw you at Wesley Stace's Cabinet of Wonders.
Just recently.
Yeah, I think it was November. And man, oh man, do you guys have as much fun as it looks like you're having?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it's usually a really fun show. I mean, one of the cool things is that Wes, you know, when I do the show, he encourages me to, and I think he does this with everybody, but he encourages me to choose my own songs. And sometimes that, you know, gives a theme to the show that it might otherwise not have had. He tends to, because I know his band pretty well too, like they tend to sometimes give me free rein to add, like we've done shows in the past where we've done like 5-6 songs, which is a lot for a guest spot, but like it's just so, it's so fun to do something that's you know, not where you're not like having to fit it in on like an album cycle or playing, feel like compelled to play certain songs. Like you can really just kind of cut loose and find a set that's fun.
The Oyster, was it Oyster Band?
Oyster Band, yeah.
Wow. That was the nail in the coffin. It was the last song you played, but yeah. That was the nail in the coffin. I'm like, oh my God, I got to look into this band.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, you know, I'm working on a new song right now that just today I realized sounds a little too much like an old Oyster Band song from like 1985. And I had to go through that process where I was like, am I going to stop this? Like, I've kind of wrung this one out. It was like taking me weeks to finish this song, you know? And I was like, am I going to trash it? And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to trash it. I'm just going to have to live with it. And if people call me out on it, people can call me out on it.
I love going to those shows.
Nowhere to run, nowhere to ride. Now wherever there's carpet, blast off with Fun Slides. The amazing carpet skates that glide, slide, or ride. You decide.
My wife went to a Catholic high school in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. She has a tendency to look a certain way at peers of hers that graduated out of that system and ended up at Notre Dame. So I think maybe I was a little surprised to see Notre Dame grad next to your name.
So tell me what her take on it is.
I think it's a little bit, I'm going to sum up in a very broad way, which is that's a choice.
Sure. Well, that's the, you know, but that's an interesting thing because I don't, you know, at least for me, it wasn't much of a choice. You know, I went to college in the 80s and it was, you know, for me going to Catholic school my entire life, like I applied to 4 colleges and they were all Catholic schools. And that was just where I was at. You know, interestingly, like my negative experiences in college and not just having to do with college, like I was going through kind of a bad time. Anyway, but certainly college, Notre Dame exacerbated it because I really, while obviously I had like plenty of positive experiences and I can't take that chapter of my life out and assume I would still be the same person, you know, so I'm not suggesting that it was not great. And none of my younger siblings went to Catholic college. So like there's definitely like, I was the last of the kind of like going back to the, you know, 50s era of aunts and uncles and parents, you know, who just went through the chute, you know, Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school, Catholic college. That was it, you know? So I maybe had a choice between Notre Dame and Holy Cross, but you know, it was going to be Catholic either way.
Was faith central to you at that time?
No. The community that, just to take it back a little bit, I mean, in my grammar school years, I was a kid and I was indoctrinated into Catholicism. So I believed in Catholicism. And, you know, looking back, I understand like, you know, why my brain gravitated to certain parts of it and didn't others and et cetera. But I was definitely, I was in there, you know, like I was an altar boy and et cetera. High school, I had a kind of interesting experience where it was a Catholic school. It was a really diverse school that sort of straddled urban and suburban New Jersey and drew kids from both sides of the tracks, as it were. And I had a really good few years there where All the, you know, all the John Hughes movie, like factions of high school actually kind of coexisted. And, you know, in not just a, live in a live kind of way, but in a like, oh, I'm kind of interested. Like I'm on the football team. I'm kind of interested in what's going on in the spring musical. Like maybe I should check that out. Or, you know, like the punks and the hip hop kids and the, you know, preppies, like all sort of got along and actually like hung out with each other. And it was all still under the aegis of being in a Catholic school. And so a lot of the kind of group activities that happened, if it wasn't sports, you know, were still kind of in that like peer ministry, like going to food banks, like all like under the, you know, under the aegis of like the Catholic, like social gospel and et cetera. And so that community was important to me under the roof of the Catholic Church. But at that point in time, like faith itself had become less important to me. And certainly the more, the more I listened to certain, you know, punk bands and stuff, like the less important it became. And, you know, going to Notre Dame in particular, like I'll tell you, I went and visited a, you know, a few colleges, and some other kids from my high school who were older than me had gone there, and I hung out with them and I stayed with them. And so in some, and I was like, oh, this is great. You know, because in some ways it was like, I was like just continuing my association with that community that I did value. My opinion of the place and my experience of the place changed very quickly once I got stuck in there, but yeah.
This is a new song and here's a new riff. I should be tied up and beat with the switch. I should be shot down and thrown in a ditch. I guess I'm on my way. This is a new song and it's in a new place. Another chance for me to try and face. I wear it out and live without a trace. I guess I'm on my way. There's no reason to stay. I guess I'm on my way. No reason to stay. This is a new time for being alone. Another chance for me to get up and go. Oh, please shut up and let me get off the boat. I guess I'm on my way. This is a new song and here's a new riff. Another chance for me to rip off a gift. I wake up at night stretched in my own piss. I guess I'm on my way. There's no reason to stay. I guess I'm on my way. No reason to stay. I should be shot down and thrown in a ditch. I guess I'm on my way. This is a new song and here's a new rhythm. Another chance for me to rip off a gift. I wake up at night stretched in my own piss. I guess I'm on my way. There's no reason to stay. I guess I'm on my way. There's no reason to stay.
Chisel started while you were a student at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then last year in 2023 re-released the Chisel record and played some dates with that band. Is that right?
A few. Yeah. Our last record came out in 97. And so we'd wanted to do a 25th anniversary reissue of the record in 2022. And then the Numero Group label approached us about doing that. And, you know, just because of the modern world and the backups at all of the final pressing plants and et cetera, it wasn't released until 2023. And then, yeah, we've done a handful of shows, just kind of in support of that reissue.
It was fun to go back and re-listen to that, 'cause it had been a while for me, mm-hmm, since I'd listened to Chisel. I think it's very interesting that listening back, you can hear foreshadowing in the music of everything that came after, I think, for you personally as a musician, as is often the case with folks' early work. What was that experience like for you revisiting those tunes?
It was cool. I think I always had a sense of that, what you just said. Obviously not while in Chisel, but like since Chisel, you know, with a little bit of hindsight. When we started that band, we were a little more still ensconced in the hardcore world and hardcore music. But John, the drummer, and I, who started it together with another bass player who I actually went to high school with and also went to Notre Dame. We were all hardcore kids, and I was still in other hardcore bands. Like, I was still playing in hardcore bands back in New York. And Chisel as a vehicle was for us, initially a way to revisit. It's funny to say this because we're talking about being 19, 20 year olds, you know, like when it started, but to like revisit earlier stuff that we'd gotten into that was, you know, loosely punk, but not necessarily hardcore. So we started playing Wire covers and Mission to Burma covers and Buzzcocks covers and Jam covers and things like that. And then gradually, as that became my main vehicle for songwriting, all of a sudden I was free of the constraints of being in a hardcore band, but still free to tap into that. And by the end of Chisel, I think I had started to be able to kind of balance a lot of those influences instead of like juggling them, which is if you take the difference, you know, like, which is what I think I was kind of doing previously on even on earlier Chisel records. And then, yeah, I think that there's a pretty clear through line from there to the Pharmacist stuff that I was doing, because that was even in some ways, because that grew out of, and again, it's funny to talk about because we're talking about a matter of a couple of years here, but like that grew out of me starting to play solo, where really like all the seatbelts are off. You can kind of do whatever you want to a degree. And I tried to carry that forward into the Pharmacist stuff and just go where the proverbial muse took me, you know.
Punk was never my jam. I've learned over the past, you know, year and a half in interviewing everyone that we've interviewed, it's a very short bridge from punk to like power pop. And I'm wondering if you can help us understand why that is.
Mm. Well, this is, I mean, I think you start, you kind of have to start getting into things that sound a little trite when you try to differentiate that. But it comes down to attitude and intent. There's plenty of Clash stuff that could, you know, easily be considered power pop were it done by another band, you know, but it's considered punk because it's the Clash, you know, because of the Clash's attitude and intent in doing what they were doing. You know, Nick Lowe, who's very punk adjacent, I don't think you would call punk because I don't think that was ever his intent, you know. Whereas there are plenty of punk bands who could write something like I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass and have it be on a punkier record and just have it be a little bit of a straying stylistically without necessarily straying from the idea that you're listening to a punk band, you know? So I know that that's a little, that saying it like intent and attitude is a little trite, but I kind of think that's what it has to come down to a certain degree. I mean, especially, I'm glad I mentioned the Clash. I'm glad for myself that I mentioned the Clash because they really are a good example of a band that when people, for example, question whether like what records I've done as Ted Leo and the Pharmacists, when they question, you know, why should they be considered punk? as opposed to like indie rock or something, one of the answers for me is, well, do you consider the Clash's London Calling an indie rock record? Because I don't. I consider it a punk record. But it's all over the place stylistically. It's got reggae, it's got acoustic guitars, it's got, pop, like real pop on it, hooks galore. But you know it when you see it or hear it or feel it that it's a punk band. And that's kind of the overlap of 100 Venn diagrams that I try to live in,
I love it when Keith sets me up. The Heavens Off, call that an EP, I guess.
Yeah.
Heavens Off, it's so very fascinating to me, the number of ways that you can get into an artist. And if your jumping in point is, and I'm talking about mechanisms here, if your jumping in point for Ted Leo is YouTube, you're going to have a different experience and a different impression than if it's Spotify.
Yeah.
And that experience is going to be different than if your jumping off point is Bandcamp. And I feel like Bandcamp is probably the most current and the most reflective of the artist. And you mentioned on that release, you're talking about the cover, The Shape of Things to Come, and how, that could have been a power pop band.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually a really, I hadn't thought of that before about if YouTube is your entree, you're going to have a very different experience. And it's true. Like you might wind up seeing the ridiculous acoustic cover of Since You've Been Gone that I did in 2006, like before you hear anything that I've done in the last 10 years,
I was going to get to that next. Yes. That's in fact, the top two hits.
Yeah.
YouTube are that, and then the very excellent cover of was it Everybody Wants to Rule the World?
Yeah, for the
AV Club.
AV Club, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. I suppose like where I had I more time and where I just more interested in doing it, I could probably juke those stats a little bit and like go into my like curate my YouTube page. But I'm working on some shows for the rest of the year with my booking engine. It's the 25th anniversary of the 20th anniversary of the Shake the Sheets album this year. And he was like, do you have a clean copy of the Me and Mia video? Because the one on YouTube has all the MTV like logo and information on it.
Wow.
And he was like, I was just wondering, maybe promoters want a clean thing. I was like, dude, I'm not fixing that on YouTube. Like, that is so like, I got so many, that's like a 29th level priority for me, to get and work on that stuff. It's all I can do to get these Bandcamp EPs out like once every 8 months, But that, to your point, the Bandcamp thing has been an experiment that has been really gratifying for me in some ways, because people have really shown up to support the things that I've put there. I feel a little bit compelled to kind of keep them siloed there for at least a while, because you know, because if it goes right to streaming, like, why are people, I feel like I have, people have ponied up some dough for those. Like, I want to let them live for, you know, where the people ponied up dough for them for a while, you know? But that does keep it siloed. And, you know, eventually I will have to call some of that stuff for a new album and take it out into the other realms, you know, streaming here and there, and et cetera. But yeah, it's been, my time has been since 2020 really, has been so constrained that, being able to do that sort of thing, like put up a 4 to 6 song EP every few months, has been good for me mentally, like kind of keeping me feeling like I'm being productive. And also allowed me to put stuff out there that people will, contribute to have, you know.
On this Heavens Off EP, you mentioned specifically, coming back to Bloom and Love's Too Long for Pike County,
mm-hmm.
having a little bit of Irish to it. On your website, when you wrote about Shane McGowan's passing, I thought it was really beautiful, the words that you put up there. I'm wondering if there's any connective tissue between you thinking about Shane and you having a little Irish coming into the music, or is that a fighting Irish thing and we're going all the way back to Notre Dame?
Oh, it's not a fighting Irish. It's not a Notre Dame thing, but it's in, but I mean, that's in me. It kind of always has been in me. You can go back to some, it's a little subtler in there, but there are plenty of even early Chisel stuff, late 80s, early 90s, where, you know, I'm like a chorus has a kind of Irish progression, or, you know, something that I'm singing about has some relevance to that. That's always in my music.
Is that an intentional? Is that something that you have maybe discovered later in life that, oh, I think that that's an Irish influence that I was unaware of, or did you seek it out?
Chicken egg, you know, like I'm Irish and Italian. And I will tell you that, like, for the first probably 20 years of my life, especially, you know, growing up, where I did in Jersey, it's very Italian. And so that was kind of like, that was a more of a kind of overarching influence. But I just started gravitating to that. I was always aware of the Irish side of my family. A lot of stories there for another podcast, but yeah, I started gravitating toward that in my 20s. It's one of those things where, certainly sometimes I'm sure that I consciously have been like, I want to push things in that direction. And other times, it's just the way it comes out.
Not to over-involve my wife, but she's a recurring theme on the podcast, so why not?
Okay, sure.
We were listening to the both, and she was unfamiliar. She said, "Who is this? What is this? This is wonderful music. How did I not know about this?"
Oh, nice.
Can't help.
for something that's been out, golly, a decade years. Now.
Yeah.
A decade. Yeah. It really feels underappreciated. And she said, yeah, it's really giving Neil Finn. And I went, oh, I didn't see that coming, but okay. And then my brain immediately went back to 6 months in a Leaky Boat.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, he's a Neil Finn fan.
Yeah, no, I definitely am. You know, that Split Enz, I was really into Split Enz when kind of like when like Wyatta came out, One Step Ahead and all that, or I guess even before, well, you know, I Got You was a radio hit. Kind of, so I knew that. But I started buying their albums with that, with the next one. They're talk about power pop. I mean, they're Neil and Tim. Thank you. Neil and Tim's, melodic sensibilities, hooks. And also, you know, I think I haven't really talked, like I haven't talked about them certainly in a long time, but not much at all. But I think they're fantastic lyric writers too. And I think that like the way that, you know, they're just great little turns of phrases and things that I'm sure, also probably influenced me more than I'm even aware of.
You know, 6 months in a Leaky Boat. I'd seen another interview with you. The interviewer described 6 months in a Leaky Boat. He said that I got to find the name of the release here. The Shark Bite Sessions was the last great release on Lookout Records.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
You've seen some records. You've seen the wheels fall off a couple different record labels.
I have.
Yeah. How did that define your career and lead you to where you are today?
I mean, and honestly, like this is a thing where I can say in ways that are only negative, to be totally honest with you. Like, who really knows, but, we were doing really well with Lookout. It was working for everybody. It is my opinion that they made, some bad choices in terms of trying to get a bigger score with someone else than what was by any metrics, like pretty decent success on an indie scale with bands like us and some others that were on the label at the time and who were working like really hard, you know, like we were on the road all the time back then, like sometimes 200 shows a year, you know, and I had like reinvested some of my royalties in the label to help them kind of keep afloat, and the label went under and they couldn't pay me back. So like that was one of the first things that really put me behind the eight ball. You know, you get back up and you get on another classic American punk label, Touch and Go, you know, huge distribution of their network of their own. Similar things happened. And they went for the most part under, like, it's kind of like they keep the lights on in the office right now, but you know, it's not really a label. And then with Matador, you know, like they're obviously still a label, but they had to reshuffle a bunch of stuff for the same reason. And, you know, you can map all, not that this, not that this is the deciding factor in any of my failures with these labels, but a factor that certainly contributed, and you can literally map it to like the years this happened, was the, you know, the growth of streaming, and the death of album buying. Because with our last record on Lookout, which was 2000, our last LP on Lookout, which was 2004, you know, to date, I think it's sold upwards of like 100K, which is really great for an indie release, you know. At the time it was like, you know, out of the box it was like 60, and like that's great. Like, we actually started making royalties on a record, which no one had ever done. None of us had ever done before. Then you can just look at like the one line go up on the graph while the other line just goes down. And then, you know, here I am putting EPs on Bandcamp. For all as wonderful as it is, it's not a record label for me. And for me to make it a record label, I would have to put in the kind of effort in essentially running my own label that I absolutely can't do. You know, I just can't do it at this point in my life. So, yeah.
Well, didn't you kind of do that?
Well, I crowdfunded the last LP. Yeah. And I did kind of do that. And, you know, that was a little bit of a reminder of why I don't want to do that. You know, I mean, it was like one thing about that I will say is that people understand this a little better now, but I think back in 2018, which now is 6 years ago, or funded in 2017, which is almost 7 years ago, spring of 2017. I don't think people quite had their heads around the fact that, like, well, I think a lot of people were using crowdfunding, and maybe they still do, as more of a pre-sale, where like they had, you know, they had their albums in production, like their artwork was done, like things are waiting at the plant just to see like how many they need to press. And it's sort of like a pre-sale. And when that happens, it's done and everything goes out. But I was actually funding my record. Like, I'm not independently wealthy, and I was funding my record with the thing. So when the thing funded, I wasn't even done making the record yet. And then it takes a couple of years to get everything in production and done. And I think that a lot of people expected it was going to be like an Amazon overnight delivery situation, you know, which it isn't. But still, cut to me, you know, during the pandemic, when I didn't really have anything else to do, thankfully, and all of the stuff was finally done, like just packing boxes, mailing boxes, putting 7 inches together, putting them in boxes, you know, taping boxes, typing out addresses, you know, just like for like an entire year, you know. And that's like, if I do that, I can't go play music, you know? So it's like, it's a little bit of one or the other for me, I think, at this point.
I don't think it's unfair to say that Touch and Go and Lookout are punk labels. Mm-hmm. You've been pretty firmly associated with punk. I don't think of Amy Mann as a punk rocker. Mm-hmm. How do you end up paired with two iconic voices working together beautifully? But it doesn't seem like something that I would pick just out of a hat.
Well, a few things to say about that. I mean, one, we were friends for a long time through kind of a lot of our mutual comedy connections. She and I, for years, were always like the musical guest on so-and-so's comedy show, you know, and so we got to be friends that way. But aware of each other's music, certainly me, I mean, I grew up with Till Tuesday, you know, so I knew that. But I know that Amy was aware, going back to like the first Lookout LP, The Tyranny of Distance, was aware of that. And I think if you remove some of the context that you just talked about, you know, who's punk, who's not, and just listen to the records side by side, you can actually see a lot of commonality and a lot of threads that connect them melodically, lyrically, etc.
Statue of Farms in the Dust. sound of the bell. You can tell it's a nucleus burning inside of the cell. It's a nucleus burning inside of the cell.
Obviously, like, my stuff skews a lot punker, you know, 99% of the time. But I think if you were to listen for melody and structure and things, like, you would see the connective tissue there. But then the thing that nobody knows about Amy is that Amy is punk. Like, Amy grew up, you know, Amy was in the punk scene in Richmond, Virginia, and the punk scene in Boston before Till Tuesday became huge. She was in a weird, like, art, no wavy kind of band called the Young Snakes. This is one of those things, like, going back to when I said, like, you kind of know it when you hear it, like, what is and what isn't, like, There's something that I think before I knew just how deep in that world, or at least, like, adjacent to it in a lot of her earlier life, you know, she had been, you talk to somebody enough, you talk about music, you talk about politics, you talk about what you value in life, and I got a sense pretty early that I was like, oh, you're punk. Like, you're kind of punk, you know? And then like, the reveal is that, yeah, she certainly was. You know? Yeah.
That's a knockout record. It's top to bottom. And the fact that on this Bandcamp EP, you know, you're bringing out some songs. It was like, yeah, Amy and I wrote this.
Oh yeah,
it didn't make that record, but I thought it was worth bringing to light. Is there a follow up, the Both record, maybe on the horizon somewhere?
Maybe. I'm not sure. You know, we still work together a lot. We do this Christmas variety show every year that actually has a lot of writing that goes into it. This year being the 10th anniversary of that record, we're talking about conceivably doing something, like, even if it's just a 7-inch, you know, we in the background, we actually help each other, write from time to time also, which is cool. But, as we got back to our own, quote unquote solo careers, after the kind of wind down on that record, and then, you know, the pandemic took everything off the table for a couple of years. We didn't move forward with anything new as the Both, but we may.
I hope so.
Oh, thanks.
Jane, what can you tell me about this man you saw last night?
He's Caucasian.
Caucasian?
Yeah, you know, a white guy with a mustache, about 6'3".
An awfully big mustache.
I was reading, I think it was the Stereogum article. Mm-hmm. After the 2016 election, you toured small towns in states that had voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is there any chance we can get you to do that before the election?
I am going to be touring this year before the election, but it's going to be, I just can't tour that much. So it's going to be kind of like, unfortunately, major markets.
Fair enough. I had to ask.
Yeah.
Well, frankly, I'm terrified.
Yeah. I don't blame you. Yeah. There's a lot to be terrified of.
How do politics inform your own writing?
Well, I think, like, with the Irish thing we talked about, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. It is natural for me to want to address issues, let's say, you know, which you could, I guess, issues slash politics, or, you know, politics parentheses issues, you know, like politics per se, like electoral politics, like I don't write about, you know, but the effect of policies that are enacted through electoral politics, I definitely write about. And some of that, you know, I suppose is you get the green light for that when you grow up listening to punk music or hip hop, which I was big into in the early 80s too and stuff, you know, it's less that, that background pushed me into writing like that, the more that, it removed a barrier to writing like that before I started writing even. So when I started writing, there was no barrier there, you know, that was within the constellation of things that one writes about, you know, and it's kind of what I gravitate to. I have a hard time shutting that out, even when I'm trying to write, when I'm making an active decision to write, you know, something that is more personal, or like a love song, you know, which is sort of rare in my repertoire. It exists, they exist, but like, it's sort of rare. But even when I try and do that, I wind up writing about, you know, like love living through the current era, or hopefully things about the current era that are universal to at least a few generations, you know, that may be listening to the music.
I've heard you talk about working for CBS and when you lived in Washington, D.C., and that puts you in a lot of places that I guess you would call it a ringside seat to a lot of this. I mean, I think it's hard to have memories of sitting on the steps of, you know, the Capitol building or the Supreme Court, not have that context and just be just ignore what happened on January 6th or, you know, with the upcoming election, you know, it's all gotta, cause it's woven into your story.
Yeah. That's interesting. I think there's something about living in Washington, D.C. in general, that, the air is suffused with the federal government, you know, and you sort of take it in, no matter what. Especially, yeah, there was, you know, I spent a lot of time in the Capitol building, at the Supreme Court, at the White House, at other spots in D.C. while I was working for CBS. And you're never unaware of what's happening. Like, even if I was just going to the Capitol to pick up a videotape and run it back to HQ at CBS so they could start editing it, I know what hearing I'm going to pick it up. You know, I know what they're talking about, you know? So right. It's like, it's actually hard to, yeah, it's hard to shut that out. Even I think I suppose if you wanted to, you could know whom you were going to and not what hearing was happening. But as soon as you know what hearing is happening, your brain is thinking about it, you know? So
you've talked a lot about the poetry aspect of things, and I think that, yeah, that's something you excel at in my measure.
Thank you.
I think for the first time I stopped and thought during that AV performance when you were doing Everybody Wants to Rule the World, I thought, man, Ted's kind of a badass guitar player.
Welcome to
we saw a lot of that with the Both record, where I was like, there's a lot of just the vocals cut out and the music takes over in the song. And there's a lot of instrumentation on that record that's like, oh, this is kind of a Ted highlight moment. If you take your voice away and you're just playing the guitar, you know, what are your aspirations as a guitar player?
First of all, thank you for saying that. I recently did another interview where somebody talked to me about my guitar playing, and this was only a couple of months ago, and it's literally like the first time in as long as I can remember that anybody wanted to talk about my guitar playing. But of course, it's a major component of what I do, so I really do appreciate you. I appreciate you thinking that. And you know, with the Both record, just to jump into that for a second, I one of the things I really appreciate about Amy, and also her bass player Paul Bryan, who produced the Both record, is that I think that they were actually kind of fascinated by my guitar playing. It is the kind of thing that is a little more unhinged than what they're used to in some ways, but I think that they liked that, and they encouraged me again to like take my seatbelt off a little bit. So there were times tracking solos where I'd be like, you know, all discombobulated after having like gone through like blah, 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 and then hit the echo plex and blah, 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 you know, and I'd be like out of breath, and like, you know, the tape would stop, and I go, okay, was that okay, like, should I do another one? And the control room's just silent, and I'm like, hello. Like, that was great. You know? So like, oh, phew. Okay. Well, you know. So that was great. I got a guitar when I graduated from high school. And I didn't really. It took me about a year or two to like really kind of get into it. But from then on, I was never, or very rarely was I ever singing without a guitar. And they very much go together for me. And I think that I was often in a three-piece. Chisel was a three-piece. A band that I did in between the Chisel and the Pharmacists called the Sin Eaters was a three-piece. Most of the early Pharmacists touring and writing was a three piece, if not, or maybe a four piece, you know. I only kind of grew the band in the last few years. So I was also the only guitar player. So I was rhythm and lead guitar player. And, that suited me just fine, because I like both of those things. I like playing rhythm guitar and I like playing lead guitar. And I think when, I forget exactly how you phrase it, but when you asked me like, you know, kind of like what I'm going for with the guitar in a way.
Yeah.
It is usually something that is not just rhythmic, but also complements the vocal melody. And whether that's while I'm playing rhythmically or while I'm doing something lead wise, I'm usually trying to do a complement, you know, a harmonic kind of complement to what's happening vocally. But I really like playing, aggressive rhythm guitar, like the kind of 60s soul rhythm guitar, you know, where there's a lot of like stabby kind of hits, you know, which became, you know, more, disjointed as you go into the kind of like noisier 70s punk world of Gang of Four and Wire and stuff like that.
I'd have gone to Husker Du, but sure.
Husker Du, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then this is a place where the Irish thing comes in, is I think that often informs my guitar solos. Like I don't often play just like a kind of rock and roll guitar solo. I kind of have two modes for that. I'm either doing something that is like skronky and
skronk, noun. In popular music, this is a kind of experimental sound that is deliberately discordant. Used in a sentence, in the right hands, skronk can be sublime.
in my brain, like maybe what like a saxophone gone off the rails is kind of is kind of going to be doing, something that's a little noisier and like, you know, hitting some weird jazz notes, you know, or I'm doing something that is very much like a melodic line in the kind of folk tradition, Irish. And I've also been heavily influenced by Ethiopian music in that regard, like the kind of, kind of long melodic string instrument lines.
Ted, you joined a growing club of cartoon artists.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sort of. Guest cartoon.
I mean, artist. We had Biss, who did Powderpuff Girls.
Mm-hmm.
Payne, who did Jabberjaw. And then you've got what, Independent Together from the Steven Universe movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
If you're familiar with the concept of living apart together, it's kind of like a living apart together song for kids.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I wrote that with Rebecca Sugar, who is the, you know, behind Steven Universe. It's funny because I knew Rebecca before I really knew how huge Steven Universe was. And so it was a funny thing when that, by the time that came out, I think I had some sense of actually how big Steven Universe is, but it caused definitely more of a splash than I had expected, which was great because I love the song. I love what they, you know, sort of turned my voice into in the actual cartoon. It's cool.
That would be a great character for what, Skronk.
Yeah, there Skronk. You go.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love that.
Skronk the cat.
What's 2024 going to look like, man? What's
big news on the website? You said big
did I?
News coming in 2024.
Well, medium news. I probably said that with tongue firmly planted in cheek. That's an indication that it's tongue in cheek. It's all caps. If it's not all caps, it's serious. If it's all caps, I'm I do have some touring. We're going to be doing some Shake the Sheets anniversary shows where we'll play the album and other stuff. Like I said, it's hard. It's actually hard for me to tour a ton right now. So it's like a week here, a weekend there, a week here, a weekend there kind of stuff. But, East Coast, West Coast, a little bit of Midwest, maybe get down to Austin, a little bit hoping for some Southeast. I mean, that's about it. I have a kind of plan to shift out of the Bandcamp silo into another way of doing things, but I haven't set it up yet, but I think I'm just gonna start a Patreon, honestly, at this point. Some new stuff to put up there is actually what I've been working on recently, because the Bandcamp thing has been great, but every time I feel like I need to put a new EP up, it's a scramble to get it, to get what I feel is enough to make it worth people's while in time for the next like Bandcamp Friday or whatever, you know? And I just started thinking about it and I was like, you know, I don't know, like, just because I'm not touring as much and I don't know what's going to happen, like label wise, I want to start putting out actual records again. So I will have to figure that out. But in the meantime, I think that a more consistent approach of trying to, instead of cram like six songs that are a quarter written, you know, into like this 1 month that I decide like I have to do a new Bandcamp EP, if I approach it on a more consistent basis and say like two songs every month, one song every month and something else extra, that seems much more achievable to me. And then also like, rather than hitting people up on Bandcamp Friday and being like, hey, can you drop a big dime on this EP? It's like, maybe just price of a coffee every month will keep me going, you know. I know enough people who've done it now that it's working out well for them. I think like one of my hesitations for a long time has been that we all have subscription fatigue. You know, I mean, it's just like that you have to subscribe to every app, you have to subscribe to every streaming service for TV and phone. You have to subscribe. It's like, you know, I am not suggesting that like one shouldn't subscribe to all these things, but I think I've been a little nervous about like adding to people's subscription piles, you know. But we'll keep it modest, keep it affordable, and you know, see what happens.
I think there's lots of examples though of artists out there that are doing it right, doing it with integrity, creating great content for the fans. And honestly, you know, I subscribe to a couple, and I think the relationship with those artists is probably more intimate than anybody else I interact with.
That's cool. That's great. They do like Q&As and things, or just the way that they post and what they talk about.
You know, Mike Dowdy's a great example where he's putting songs out that you know, he's got a pretty solid groove with his in-house production. But he's knocking out songs that sound just as good as some of his big budget produced records.
Yeah.
And they're only available in that medium. So I think there's, you know, he's talking to people and Mike's not exactly, you know, he's not going to open up his diary or he's not going to open up his diary, but the music is great. And then, you know, you get a postcard from him. Right. And that's like, you get that in the mail, and especially if he doesn't announce it per se, he's like, hey, by the way, this month I sent everybody a postcard. Enjoy. Like, that's fun.
Yeah, that's cool.
If he's a pal of yours, tell him that he should come on the show.
I will.
Yes, please. I will. we've taken up a bunch of your time. Great, great chat.
I'm glad.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
No, you're welcome. It was fun.
This was wonderful, Ted. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, you guys. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Many thanks to Ted for stopping by for a chat. Be sure to check out his Patreon, Bandcamp, and website. We have links for all three in the show notes.
This episode of Abandoned Albums was written and produced by Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun. The show was recorded at Thunderlove Studio, where it was engineered by
Daphne Morris,
with help from
Penetration.
Abandoned Albums was edited by
Mike Hunt,
with help from
Vic Titball.
We're sad to say that after five seasons, this is Mike's last show with us. He's headed onward and upward to the upcoming Ruth Buzzy podcast. Vic Titball will be taking over. Our theme song is Solo Flight by Charlie Christian. In the opening of the show, the songs you heard were The Ballad of Peter Pumpkinhead by XTC, Never Say Never by Romeo Void, and The Walls Came Down by The Call. You can stream all of those artists wherever you stream your favorite music.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
The songs you heard during this podcast were Me and Mia by Ted Leo and the Pharmacists, Rip of the Gift by Chisel, a cover of The Shape of Things to Come, You Can't Help Me Now by The Both. You also heard Milwaukee by The Both, featuring Ted Leo and Amy Mann, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which is Ted Leo and the Pharmacists covering Tears for Fears. And finally, Independent Together, by Ted Leo from Steven Universe. You can stream all of Ted's work, including the both, wherever you stream your favorite music. Also, be sure to check out Ted's Patreon and Bandcamp pages to help support independent artists.
If you like what you've heard, please remember to subscribe and leave us a rating. It helps other people find the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Grazie.
Bailey Leaf.
Rob Janicki. Mike Pellegrino. Therina Vella.
Eric Beatner. S.W. Loudon. Ronnie Barnett.
Michael Janicki. Peyton Janicki. And our executive producer.
Rufus Thunderwolf.
Abandoned Albums receives funding from Damon Pharmaceuticals, the makers of Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck is the only chewable tablet made to combat stomach unease associated with mediocrity. Taken daily, Ben Affleck can help combat explosive gastrointestinal shame. You can find a multitude of flavors in the incontinence section of your local pharmacy. Ben Affleck, save yourself the embarrassment.
The side effects include dry mouth, headache, anal leakage, muscle soreness, bad decisions, gender confusion, constipation, evil spirit possession, and banality. Use only as directed.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.
And now, a word from our sponsor.